Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 26. Ben Flanagan of Aspect Radio. Matt Scalisi, editor of FilmNerds.com.
Hey, Matt. It's Ben.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, man. I am on the way to the movie theater. I'm leaving Birmingham after a work meeting and going to Tuscaloosa to see Cameron Crowe's new movie, Aloha, which is his follow-up to We Bought a Zoo, a movie that very few people, even diehard Cameron Crowe fans, have a lot to say about. They're just sort of meh on it, even more so than his movie that he preceded that with, Elizabethtown. So Cameron Crowe, at this point, has a lot of, I guess, making up to do with his fans who believe he's on a bit of a cold streak and maybe even losing his fastball. And this is a topic that we with FilmNerds.com and my show Aspect Radio have explored in recent years about our favorite directors who aren't out of the game just yet, but might be losing a step, if not it altogether. And I want to piggyback on the discussion that you and Ben Stark had about directors who have or may have tarnished their reputations and their legacies as directors, once titans in the industry and responsible for some of the greatest movies ever made or just great movies in general, who now have made movies that have almost erased the goodwill that they created with those films. But now, Matt, I'm scared here going to see Aloha. I'm scared that with this movie that has been panned by critics, and I don't let buzz or what, you know, the Rotten Tomatoes score says influence how I feel about a movie, but seeing the trailer and what I've seen from it so far, that it doesn't suggest that I'm going to get the Cameron Crowe that gave us Say Anything, Jerry Maguire, and the movies that we do love from him, and I fear that this movie is going to show me that we have lost Cameron Crowe. So I wonder if this topic is something that you think about. Are there any directors that in recent memories where you've seen a movie at the theater or watched on video where you've just kind of had that sad realization that this guy has lost it?
Oh, yeah, there's a bunch. I mean, I think some of it probably isn't quite as fair because I think there's a lot of guys who start really strong. Maybe they have a great first or second movie. And, you know, I think maybe sometimes in the end we start to – they might get labeled as guys who, quote-unquote, lost their touch. But it might have just been a situation where the – you know, everything about the production they were involved in and became famous for just went right for them. And, you know, the project came together well. I'm sure I'd love to have Ben Stark's take on this as a filmmaker. But, I mean, I think – we've all read about movies where just everything came together perfectly and, you know, it wasn't necessarily all down to one guy's creative voice. So I think sometimes you can luck out. But I do think there are some guys who had long stretches where they were making important, relevant, great stuff, and they just don't do it anymore. And, you know, it always makes me a little bit bummed. And a lot of these guys, I still see a lot of their movies, even though I kind of go into it expecting
yeah.
to let me down, but I just want them to be good again so badly that I'm willing to watch their bad stuff, their stuff that just isn't quite as good anymore.
Isn't that depressing? Like, I mean, I think of a movie like The Ward that John Carpenter made, and I see it sitting there, and I think, I know this is probably going to suck. And it's been decades now since John Carpenter has made a great movie, but I'm still tempted just to see if there are just glimmers of hope in there that show me the guy who made Escape from New York.
Yeah, and he was a guy who was so inventive, too. That's part of the thing I think that that's almost like a subcategory of these guys is, you know, guys who came out of the gate of their careers looking like they wanted to sort of change the way movies were made. And you know, they just I think you can just only sustain that level of energy for so long. And it also sort of happens that's a bit of being a product of your time. You know, it's having an idea at the exact right time and place to have that idea, and it puts you at the front of the pack for a little while, but you know, maybe you don't have that second revolutionary idea. And John Carpenter is a great example of that. I just think his visual style and also just conceptually the films he wanted to make, they were different than what people were making at the time. So, you know, he had this edge that just not many other people had when he came around. And I think he influenced a lot of other filmmakers, but it's hard to keep that. It's hard to stay at the front of that pack. Another guy that actually reminds me a lot of that style of, you know, career path, I guess, would be Ridley Scott, who was a guy who kind of around the same time Carpenter was becoming a big deal. That's really when Ridley Scott was becoming a big deal too, and really on a larger scale almost. But you know, there was a real stretch there where he was making stuff that just was mind-blowing, and even if you go back and look at the other movies from that time, it just seems so far ahead of what everybody else was doing visually. It just seemed like he had so much more, you know, almost aggression to what he was making. And, you know, it's really faded. I mean, I think the kinds of movies he's made over the last couple of decades are big movies, and they look like really well-made, polished Hollywood products, but they just don't have the same impact that they did when he was back in the late 70s, early 80s.
No, yeah, you can definitely see it with Ridley Scott. He definitely feels like a different director, almost like a director for hire even. And, you know, maybe he has the same mindset that he did when he made Blade Runner and Alien and some other great movies in the 80s and 90s. But the movies he makes today, no matter how polished they are and how well done they are, and they certainly don't have the vibrancy and vigor of those movies that established him as a unique voice in the art form. A guy that I think about all the time when it comes to losing his fastball, still to this day, is Tim Burton.
Yeah, he's on my list here. Yeah.
Yeah, somebody who just stormed out of the gate back in the 80s and had arguably the most unique, at least visual, voice and palette in film back when he was making Beetlejuice and Batman and went into the 90s with, I mean, even what I think is his best movie to this day, and Ed Wood, and what I think was his last good movie, Sleepy Hollow, in the late 90s, and a guy who just, I don't know, got a little too comfortable. You know, maybe he felt like he did exactly what he wanted to do, made the films he wanted to, and is now just kind of doing it for money or just as a job and to keep himself going. But I mean, when a movie like Big Eyes comes out and Big Fish even, and just to think back on what Tim Burton used to be and what he had to offer for, you know, as a storyteller and as a visual artist, and just to see, you know, a movie like Alice in Wonderland with such a gross CG dependency, it's just not the same guy. A movie like that just completely stands for the opposite of what he used to, with the amount of effort and production design and cinematography that he would put into movies like Beetlejuice and Batman.
Yeah, you mentioned, you bring up a question there, Ben, about making the films he wants to make. I mean, I think it's almost impossible to watch some of these recent ones he's made and think, I mean, I cannot watch Alice in Wonderland and think that the person who made it it has had this sort of creative spark and just decided this film must be made. Like, it just doesn't feel that way, in the way that Ed Wood, for example, which, I mean, I guess it's a little bit atypical of his filmography, but that's a movie that so obviously refuses to compromise what it's doing to entertain the audience. It is not there to entertain anybody, despite the fact that it is an entertaining movie to watch. That is so obviously from start to finish feels like a movie where the director is, you know, just like the character of the movie, he is desperate to make that movie. He has got to tell that story. And you just don't feel that desperation from him. And I mean, I'd have to go back and look. I don't have his filmography open in front of me, but what would you say is probably the last Tim Burton movie that you just felt like it was something he just had to get out of him?
I think Sleepy Hollow is the one that comes to mind for me, but there are shades of that Tim Burton in his Sweeney Todd adaptation, where you see just these elements of what made Tim Burton so great, also blended with the filmmaker that he's become, again, with the reliance on CG and sort of kitschy storytelling, you know, mechanics that weren't present in something that had so much more energy and edge as those 80s and 90s movies that he made. So Sleepy Hollow would be the one that I would go back to and think, well, this was still a guy who was having fun making movies, and this feels like something that, like you said, he is desperate to realize on screen. And I think that is such a key word, is desperation, something that they have the urge and burden to get on screen as fast as they can, and as delicately as they can, and they're the only people that could possibly do it. And it's so hard, Matt, and it's such a depressing thing to really contemplate, because we talk about these guys who we think have lost it or know have lost it in our movie going hearts. But I mean, there remain the people, the titans, obviously, who are especially talented and are unparalleled, like Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese and Woody Allen, guys who are getting up there in age but still got it. You know, they still have that, either it's the creative bug or they still have a talent that these guys who have lost it don't have. I'm not sure what separates them other than being obviously just historically great filmmakers, but you think back on the John Carpenters and Tim Burtons and Ridley Scotts and think, well, they had it, and they what stopped them from keeping going like these other guys who still have that edge that forces them to make movies like Shutter Island and Munich and God, Blue Jasmine. I mean, Blue Jasmine feels like something that Woody Allen from the 1970s and 80s would have made.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, I think it's interesting that we kind of grouped that whole group together. But there's another thing that I think you can see on another, almost on a different sort of time scale, that if you go back and look at this group of guys that came out of the early 90s, I think we've already seen a bunch of them start to do the same thing. It just obviously happened on a different, a different scale of time for them. But, I mean, you look at kind of this group of guys, and I'll throw Kevin Smith in there. I think maybe Sam Raimi I would put in there, Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin Tarantino. You know, really, in my mind, one of those four guys still is making movies with the level of energy and commitment and passion that he was doing when he was showing off his movies at Sundance in like 1994. And it's Tarantino. Every movie Tarantino makes, to me, and I'm not going to say everything he's done is perfect, but I think he's very excited about everything he makes still. I don't think that's true with Kevin Smith. I definitely don't think it's true with Robert Rodriguez. And Sam Raimi just has, his career just taken such a different path than it maybe looked like it was going to in the 80s. You know, that group of guys just doesn't, they're sort of a generation younger than the Ridley Scotts and Tim Burtons and John Carpenters, but it's happened in that group too, I think.
Yeah, Kevin Smith's a really good example. I think some of these guys fall into the trap of trying to rebottle the magic that put them there in the first place, instead of just staying true to the artists that they are and really overthinking themselves, buying into their hype, and then they sort of lose that creative edge. I think that those are really good examples. Sam Raimi's a tough one, though, because in 2009, it felt like we got Sam Raimi, the horror director, back with Drag Me to Hell. That's a movie
right. That
I love seeing in theaters and revisiting, and it just felt like the guy who made the Evil Dead trilogy again. And since then, you know, we haven't seen something similar, and I certainly hope we do, but it's not in producing remakes of Poltergeist, that's for sure.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly what it is, I think, but it almost feels like there's an element of, if you go too many movies where you don't seem to have had that energy behind it, if you take too long off from doing what it is that makes you great and what you want to do, it seems like you can't get it back, you know? I'm not sure. I would probably have to go back and check that theory against everybody. But it does seem like all of these guys, as I go looking at them individually, at some point they kind of said, okay, I'm going to take this departure from what it is I do, whether it's because I got a big studio contract to do it or I just wanted to try something else for a little while. But it's like if they move away from their wheelhouse for too long, it's kind of hard to get back the mojo that made them great.
Yeah. Yeah, or if they have a failure, you know, and,
right.
and people don't love them the same way they did with Clerks and other debuts or you know, the first few movies that they've made. If they have that failure, then it might hit them in a way that they've, you know, never been hit before, and it stunts their creative growth, and that makes them want to go back to square one, and I need to make Clerks again or something like it, and they don't have that in them. I mean, they were just different people and different filmmakers at the time that they made those first few movies that people love so much. But, you know, you have guys like, again, Martin Scorsese and Woody Allen, these guys who have made bad movies before and somehow have the wherewithal and the patience and the humility to regroup and get back on track and make great movies again. Maybe they just have different and unique passions for filmmaking still to this day that those guys don't yet. I still see Tim Burton making movies, you know? Cameron Crowe's still making romantic comedies that, you know, seem like, on paper, seem like Say Anything and Jerry Maguire just because of the subject matter that they're broaching. But they, once you see them, you just don't sense that they belong in the same ballpark, and you start to get sad and you start to want to ignore these movies. You know, I know that you're obviously a huge fan of Francis Ford Coppola because, I mean, I know The Godfather and those movies are some of your favorites, if not your personal favorites. I mean, when you see stuff like Youth Without Youth and Tetro and Twixt, I mean, do you think, oh no, I've lost Francis Ford Coppola, he's lost his fastball, or are you satisfied with the films that came before those and just think, you know, I've always got those. I'm not too worried that he's not making great movies anymore.
I feel differently with him. I actually think that the stuff that he's done the last few years, I mean, I think it's interesting that he's doing that. I don't think he's the same guy that made those movies from the 70s. You know, I don't think he's been that guy for a long time. But, you know, I think it's interesting that he's had this third act in his career. And, I mean, to me, he's fine. I don't think it's tarnished anything, and I don't feel like we were cheated of having more great Francis Ford Coppola movies. I think I would have felt that way if Quentin Tarantino just sort of went off the rails after Jackie Brown. And I think probably I do feel that way a little bit about Robert Rodriguez when I look at some of the how much fun I had watching the Mariachi movies, and then think about the fact that he spent so many years of his life now making these Spy Kids movies and these Machete movies, these movies that were basically a joke as a part of this fun little grindhouse, you know, experiment thing he did. And he turned it into like three movies and basically is just making more movies exactly like it. You know, it's just such a shame to me because I would have really loved to see more movies where Robert Rodriguez was actually trying to make a good movie. You know, I would like to see, I feel a little bit that way about Sam Raimi, especially when you go back and watch the Evil Dead movies. I just, there's nobody else that does anything like that anymore. So we just, it's not like he's been replaced. And I certainly think he's had an influence, but I think we missed out, you know. But there's, with Coppola, it's different. I think he did what he did, and he's a different guy now. I'll throw a name out there that's a little bit controversial in this discussion, and I definitely put a huge disclaimer and an asterisk on this, that I think these guys are not exactly what we've been talking about. But I don't really think the Coen brothers are the same filmmakers that they were. that I still like every, I like almost everything they make. And I think they're still making very important movies that are extremely effective to me. But I don't think they are the same. I think this isn't losing your fastball, but it's changing what you do.
Yeah.
And I kind of miss what they used to do. I kind of want to see a movie. I want to see a movie made by the guys who made Miller's Crossing and Fargo and Raising Arizona. And I think that while they make great movies still, I don't think they make movies in the same way that they did in the 90s.
I'll be honest with you, Matt. I mean, upon further review, I feel like Inside Llewyn Davis and A Serious Man fall in line with those movies and Barton Fink and the great Coen Brothers movies that we have come to know and love. I think you can look at something like a good movie that they have made, or good movie that they have made that definitely feel different texturally. It's something like Intolerable Cruelty or True Grit, even, where those don't necessarily share the same tone. And they just don't seem like they're necessarily part of the same family, but they're still very entertaining and very good movies. I remember when I saw Lady Killers, that's when I started to get really worried about the Coen brothers, and I thought to myself, are they losing it? Is it possible? But thank God they rebounded in such huge ways with movies like Burn After Reading and the ones I just mentioned. So thank God we can fall into the same category as Spielberg and Woody Allen and Martin Scorsese, guys who can make bad movies. It's possible that these seemingly untouchable creative voices and filmmakers could they couldn't possibly make a bad movie. But no, it is possible. But thankfully, more often than not, that's not going to happen. But now I get what you're saying for sure. There are times when I even watch A Serious Man and Inside Llewyn Davis where I think, okay, these are different now. But upon revisiting them, they share more with those movies from the 90s that the Coen brothers made than anything. But yeah, it's just so frustrating and depressing to even think about this. And it's a topic that I don't like to talk about or think about, but it's just a reality that you have to accept that your favorite filmmaker is not going to make great movies forever. I mean, sometimes it's true with the guys that we've just mentioned. They just have that weird chip in them where it's just part of their DNA that they have to keep working and thinking and creating in the way that they always have, or in completely new ways in some cases. But again, I mean, I'm minutes away from buying a ticket for this movie Aloha, which people call one of the worst movies of this year so far, Cameron Crowe's worst movie ever. And they could be completely wrong. I'm going in with such low expectations that it's possible that I'm going to come out of there saying, no, everybody's wrong. Cameron Crowe is great. This is the best movie he's made since Almost Famous. I hope that I say that. And that's just something that I hope to say going into any movie that I see from a director that I love or once loved. And sadly, Cameron Crowe is one of those guys that I once loved. There are things about We Bought a Zoo that are nice and fun and heartwarming, and same goes for Elizabethtown. I mean, but I'm getting tired of saying, yeah, the soundtrack's pretty good, I guess, with Cameron Crowe movies, instead of, no, I came out of there with kind of like a new sense of how to think about relationships with my family and my wife and just I felt like Say Anything and Jerry Maguire were movies that were not only just great mainstream entertainment, but they're movies that really had something to say and something unique to say and were done in a really, unique way and came from a voice like Cameron Crowe, a guy who wrote Fast Times at Ridgemont High, for crying out loud. And we're a long way from 1982 or whenever that movie came out. But God, man, I'm just so worried going into Aloha.
Well, we'll see what happens. I'd love for him to be a guy that we can get excited about again. So we'll see what happens. Good luck.
Thanks, man. I don't feel too good about it, but, I'll report back and let everybody know. But, yeah, thanks for taking a minute, man.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.